This is session 333, and it's Movies Most Mormon. And we have as our panelists myself, Stephen Carter, I'm the editor of Sunstone, and we have Randy Astle, who is the director of the Sunstone Symposium Film Festival, which I have attended much of, and it has been fantastic and weird and strange.
It's been three more films this afternoon. It's down in the theater at the end of the, like, away from everything else.
And they're really interesting because they're all independent yet working within Mormonism. I watched this one that had a totally church aesthetic. It had like the upper middle class feel to it. Everybody was pretty. It had really nice photography and golden light. And at the end, this ailing father gets his son, his gay son, to put his hands on his head to give him a blessing. It was so weird because I thought for sure the gay son would repent. But no! So, yeah, go and look at it. I'm really looking forward to next year's. And then we have Lisa Butterworth, who is the founder of Feminist Mormon Housewives. And we have Rachel Mabee Whipple, who is the head of LDS Earth Stewardship.
And I'm just the chair of the board.
Oh, the chair of the board, yeah.
It's a temporary gig.
Okay,
I decided. It's hard work.
And she also sponsors a movie night in her neighborhood. And then we have John Hatch, who is the acquiring editor of Signature Books and a movie snob, if I have ever met one. So I'm going to start. So the parameters are we choose just two movies, one rated G, one rated R, and we pull Mormonism out of it. So I'm going to start, and I'm going to start with... I've already given it away because it's all up there.
Hey.
So, oh yeah, I should use the mic. Send it on down. Thank you.
What kind of Sunstone employee are you?
No, I'm a terrible Sunstone employee. So, most of us here have gone through Mormonism's borderlands, so to speak, and. One of the interesting things to me is how you encapsulate the Mormon borderlands experience. Like, what kind of metaphor can reveal the heart of being in the borderlands? And so being an English major, I combed through all the literature I had read, looking for some help. I contemplated the art I'd seen. I contemplated poetry and philosophy. And then it came to me, the perfect analogy for my borderlands experience. And... definitely one of the greatest heroes of our age. Buzz Lightyear! Okay, so why is Buzz Lightyear a great metaphor for a borderlander? It's really interesting to watch Buzz Lightyear come into being because he comes down in a spaceship and he has a mission and there's Star Command and he's receiving messages. And he has his little wrist radio communicator that he's constantly talking with Star Command. He knows where he's come from, why he's here, and where he's going. And to me, that is pretty much what being a Mormon is like. Especially when you're first starting out. You are a Buzz Lightyear. I totally understood him when he came in. And so, of course, throughout the movie, Buzz starts to... get these inklings that he is in fact, oh the heresy, a toy, and that he and you know there's eventually this scene where he show it to us where he tries to fly and it does not work out and he ends up chugging down Darjeeling with a bunch of dolls, and he has completely lost any kind of feeling that he is worth anything because he lost Star Command. He lost his radio communicator. He found out it was a sticker. And when I first started contemplating him as a Mormon metaphor, I was very much in that position. I was still at the Tea Party, having no idea who I was, what I was doing, if there was anything worthwhile, finding out that I was sort of a toy. So the really interesting thing about Buzz's particular realization is that he comes to this realization in a community of people who already know that they are toys. So it's easy for him to understand that he is a toy and to build a new identity around that, one that fulfills him. But when you're a Mormon and you go into the borderlands, it's as if you are it's as if you were at Star Command's training academy, like the MTC of Star Command, right? And you're starting to realize that your radio is peeling off of your arm, and you're like, what's going on? But you're surrounded by other Buzz Lightyears, right? And so nobody is going to believe you that you are, in fact, a toy. And that is what it's like. That was what it was like for me going into the Borderlands, was I was in Star Command, and everybody was like, who in the world are you, and why are you telling me these awful, untrue things? So Buzz Lightyear had it easy. He had a supportive community. And sometimes I think that it would be better if the Mormon community were more supportive of its Borderlanders, of its Buzz Lightyears. But then sometimes I think, no, actually, you do need to go through that period where you are absolutely alone so that you can create yourself from the ground up. And I go back and forth between those two things. I'm not sure which one is best. So realizing that I am just a toy actually doesn't take the spirituality out of Mormonism completely. Because in the metaphysics of the Toy Story universe, there really isn't a Star Command. He really is a toy. There really is no ontological... That's not the right way to say it. There is nothing out there. They are just toys. But in my what I've learned from going through Buzz's particular journey is that the universe is larger than I had thought it was. And what that means is that even though there is the possibility of an actual Star Command as conceived of by my brain, or there is the possibility of an actual Kolob as conceived by Joseph Smith's brain, and that, you know, the plan of salvation actually goes the way that it says it goes, that's a tiny little metaphor of what could actually be happening. What Buzz Lightyear has taught me is that at every point in my journey, the universe will always be bigger than I thought it was. At every point. I may get to a point where I think that I know what's going on, but at every point, the universe is always bigger than I think it is. And to me, this is beautiful and absolutely Mormon, because Joseph Smith argued that we are in the process of eternal progression, which means we're constantly realizing that the universe is bigger than we thought it was. And it keeps on getting bigger and more complex and more beautiful. And so instead of thinking, oh man, I'm just going to end up in the celestial kingdom producing babies and running my own worlds, no, it's going to be bigger and more beautiful than that. That's what I learned from Toy Story. Now I want to tell you about a movie that none of you have seen except Miriam, who has watched it with me like 3 times. Have any of you seen Heaven, directed by Tom Tykwer? Oh, that's right, because that's you right. Saw my post on Facebook. Awesome. Okay, so I never really got into Jesus either. I'm not going to put... Oh, wait, yeah, you're right. I should absolutely put up the poster. Here we go. Okay, so I never really got into Jesus. He was the guy who was always looking over my shoulder to see if I was being good. He was the one whose musical tastes I needed to take into consideration. He was the one I needed to dress for and talk like. He was the perfect example I would never be able to live up to. And in the pictures, he was always blow-dried, pleasant, and unmemorable. So I realized that he's the savior of the world, that he died on the cross, that he wrought the atonement. But everything that I learned from Mormonism, he just never compelled me. And then I watched this movie, Heaven, with Cate Blanchett and Giovanni Ribisi. And so that's pre-Elf Queen Cate Blanchett. And this movie was based on a trilogy by Krzysztof Klizowski and Krzysztof Peizwitz, who made the Three Colors trilogy and The Double Life of Veronique, which are like Polish/French films that very few people have seen. You've seen them, though. I can tell by the way you're nodding. They're beautiful, enigmatic films that I really love. And Tom Tykwer made Run, Lola, Run, which is one of my like top 5 films of all time. So I said, How could I possibly miss? So I'm going to give you the basic plot. Giovanni Ribisi. No, let's start with Philippa. Oh, I missed a page. There we go. How much time have I got? Oh, man. I got to go fast. Okay, so Kate Blanchett plays Philippa, a school teacher, and she's putting together a bomb in the opening scenes, which she puts in a garbage can in an executive's office, hoping to kill him. But a maid comes along, takes the bomb out, and puts it in her garbage can, and she gets into an elevator with a family, and the bomb goes off there. So Kate Blanchett is brought in by the police, and they're convinced that she's a terrorist, and she has no idea that she just killed a family. So during the interrogation scene, Giovanni Ribisi, whose name is Filippo, is brought in to be a translator. And he watches her as she is told of what her actions actually caused. All she wanted to do was to kill a scum who was the head of a drug ring that had been killing her school children. And the police wouldn't do anything about it because they were in her pay. They were in his pay. So she just wanted to kill him, and instead she ends up killing a family, and it just devastates her. And she just, like, loses all of her will to do stuff. And he sort of falls in love with her, and he decides that he's going to help her escape. So through a fun little choreographed escape, they end up in the attic of the police building, and they later escape into the countryside where Philippa grew up. So up until this point, the movie has been a smart, suspenseful thriller. And then they hatch a little plan where they call the drug lord over, and Giovanni and Filippo locks him in a room with Philippa, who is Kate Blanchett, and she shoots him and he dies. So by thriller standards, we should be done now because we killed the bad guy. But this is a different movie. It's a movie about a soul. It's a movie about Kate Blanchett's soul. So they go into the countryside, and they go to the place where Philippa grew up, and they go into a church where this amazing scene takes place, and I hope that it's still on. You can do it, man. Still paused. Play.
I've done a lot of damage, and it was stupid. Stupid things. I've lied to my mother and to my sister many, many, many times. I was unfaithful to my husband once, and I didn't do everything I could to save him. Anyway, maybe it's not possible to do everything. Four people died because of me, and I can't live without. I'll never be able to. I shot a defenseless person, which you know. But what you don't know is I've ceased to believe.
Ceased to believe in what?
In sense, in justice.
I love you.
No. It's just that I want the end to come soon.
Okay, so that is it's sort of the center point of the entire film, and you're actually lucky that I'm not bawling my eyes out because I love this scene. So let's see. So it's really interesting to see how Philippa confesses her sins here. She starts with the smallest and ends with the weightiest. And interestingly enough, it's not the destruction of the family or the premeditated killing that is the worst to her, but losing her faith. She believes she doesn't have any belief that there's any sense in the universe. She's completely lost. And so the interesting thing is, he listens to all of this, and he still says, "I love you." So there are plenty of hints throughout the movie that Filippo is supposed to symbolize Jesus. He's the son of the police chief. He was born on the day that Philippa took her first communion. And now the story is... if the story were following the direction that I'm used to hearing in Mormonism and in Christian discourse, at this point, Filippo would hold out his hand and he would say, you know, something like, "Come follow me," and, you know, repent. But the complete opposite happens. He follows her. Filippo's father comes and finds him, and he offers to take Filippo back to get him off easy because he's the police chief. And he asks Filippo if she loves his son, and after a pregnant pause, she realizes that she does. And when she says this, then Filippo says, "I'm staying with her." So this perspective on Jesus had never crossed my mind. According to this movie, Jesus is the person who knows the totality of your brokenness. But he still understands your heart. He saw all of her crimes, but he understood her heart. And when he appears in your life, it's not to make you into someone else, it's to travel with you down your unique, harrowing, irredeemable path. And you're never so broken that he won't love you. So her final confession, "I don't believe in anything," was the worst part, and he still stuck with her. So this may sound like I'm regurgitating the party line, but I'm going to reiterate it. I was never once introduced to this perspective on Jesus. He was presented as someone perhaps who loved me in my brokenness, but it was always followed up with Jesus wanting me to be like him. He was someone who wanted to change me. He was always badgering me to keep the commandments. He was the nice police officer who wanted me to come back inside the law. But in this case, he was the nice policeman who left the law to follow. Even though he knew that I was utterly lost and could never do anything for him. So he's not just the guy who's willing to sit through the movie of my life. He's willing to be my life. He's willing to give up his promising career to get me out of jail. He's willing to hold the door while I shoot the drug lord. That had never crossed my mind before. He's willing to give up his privilege to stay with me. He wants to be at one with me. But becoming one doesn't mean that either one of us gives up our identity for the other. It means that two beings come together, the entirety of each being present in order for full at-one-ment to occur. So there's actually a lot more to this movie, and I haven't actually given away the ending yet. So it's on Netflix. You should watch it. I'm done now. Thanks, everyone. Okay, we said that Rachel is next.
Okay. I need the sound cable, too, for this one.
Okay.
So, how do you pick a movie, right? That's an awful thing. Oh, I just blewed out because I hooked in. Let's get my computer... My computer is dying. So when I was thinking about what movies that I wanted to do, my very favorite movie is Gross Point Blank, but I didn't want to try to do the gymnastics to make that Mormon in some way. I think I'm going to introduce my son to that this year. He's 14. I think he can finally handle it. there we go. Oh, crap. Here, I'm going to unplug this for right now so that you guys don't see my notes. And then I was starting to think, you know, I love The Big Lebowski or Fearless, with both have Jeff Bridges. I like The World According to Garp with Robin Williams. And what I ended up getting was The Fisher King, which has both of those actors, and it's a Terry Gilliam film. How many of you guys know this movie? This is a great movie. This is so great. So this is a Grail Quest movie, and as there are other movies that are Grail movies that are more Mormon than this, like Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which for some reason Mormon teenagers still love, and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which was just quoted at Sunstone yesterday. So for me, I was raised on a mix of Star Wars, which Stephen deliberately excluded from the panel, Arthurian legends, and the Book of Mormon. And by the way, Arnold Freeberg illustrations for the Book of Mormon make perfect sense if you've also been raised on Conan the Barbarian, Jason and the Argonauts, Lady Hawk, and then, you know, moved into Xena Warrior Princess in high school. So that's my background. And that means that for me, magicians and magic, priests, Jedi Knights, that's all the same thing in my mind. The Holy Ghost, priesthood, the Force, one. So they're different names for the same phenomena in different contexts, and these homologous ideas arise in different traditions and times as proof of our universal human nature to believe in such things, our compulsion to create and embrace stories in which such awesome powers are possible, just as we are determined to believe in free will and moral agency. As a Grail Quest movie, so we're doing The Fisher King, it's about loss and being lost and redemption. And as such, it resonates well with those steeped in the Christian tradition, even if they happen to be Mormon. So my first clip, let's get my little computer back, starts with Jeff Bridges as Jack. He's a shock jock. And we will watch this. He is... Come, computer, you can do it. Okay. He is... practicing lines for a sitcom.
And the voice. Or maybe just Jack.
Oh, my poor
computer. Honey! Where's my orange cup for the teddy bear? Oh, I'll kill that old bitch. I have a fever. I really think I'm gone.
So he's practicing lines for a sitcom that he's going to be in.
Hey. Forgive me.
Like Jack Nicholson there.
Stands for everything that you and I fight for, Edwin. They must be stopped before it's too late. It's us or them.
It was Mr. Lucas's offhand remark that seemed to have fatal impact on Mr. Melnick. Mark Saffron is on the scene.
An after-work hotspot, Babbitt's is popular with single young professionals. Edwin Melnick arrived at the peak hour of 7:15, took one long look at the handsome collection of the city's best and brightest, then removed a shotgun from his overcoat and opened fire. Seven people were killed before Mr. Melnick turned the gun on himself and shot a hole through his head. Representatives of radio cult personality Jack Lucas expressed regret. However, no formal comment has been made. Neighbors of Melnick said he was a quiet man who lived alone. He scarcely knew he was there, said a woman who lived next door to Melnick for 11 years. But today, few will soon forget this lonely man who reached out to a world he knew only through the radio.
looking for friendship and finding only pain and tragedy. Mark Safran, Channel 7 News.
So, that's our setup for this movie. And being a Terry Gilliam film, this quickly takes us into the bizarre and the banal. We have Jack 3 years later. He's been drunk. Ah! Computer, work with me. Okay. But this forgive me scene is so crucial to me because he's saying this as a boast of someone who knows no sin because he has no conscience at this point. He's too self-obsessed to feel anything but his self-obsession. He is, in a word, an asshole. He practices these lines, this catchphrase for a sitcom in a way that proves that the words are foreign to him, and as he plays with the words all evening, he proves that the concepts of remorse and forgiveness are foreign as well. So, I'm not going to tell you everything that happens in this movie, but Jack gets thrown into a group of people that he would have despised before, that he still actually does despise. And it's as though he's in the most needy, dysfunctional ward ever. And he's still so full of himself, even in his drunkenness, that he doesn't realize that he's just as broken as his fellow sufferers in this kind of profane purgatory. So this movie is structured as The Knight's Quest, and as such, it's a man's story, which men think is universal in the way that they tend to think all men's stories are, but not any woman's. The women in this film are not questing, they're not seeking. As in Spenser's Fairy Queen, they represent the clear path through danger, the safe harbor from the storm, redemption, and reward. Anne, who is Jack's girlfriend, is the personification of long-suffering love, patient and put upon, but strong enough to stand up for herself and kick that jerk out when he finally needs it. Linda is Perry, so Perry is the Robin Williams character. She's Una for him, also from The Fairy Queen. She's the gentle guide through desperate peril, the patient watcher over the wounded knight. These women are not on a quest, and they don't have the same developmental journey, but the men's progress would be impossible without them. None of these characters map neatly onto the Fisher King legend, which Robin Williams tells at one point in the story, or any particular Arthurian tale, or even the Pinocchio story, which is referenced as a recurring theme. They are, as we are, every character in our own stories. The threatening Red Knight, the grim specter of violence and devastation, we are the questing knights, the Fisher King, who is by turns hopeful and hopeless and ultimately saved by the happenstance passing goodness of someone who's around us. So I'd like to show another little clip if I can. And this is...
You have about 7 minutes.
Shh.
Just let you know.
Yeah, okay. This one's like a 1 minute clip. Okay, let's skip to chapter 6. Okay, you guys.
Holy Grail is.
Holy Grail? Yeah, I know that one. That was like Jesus' juice quiz. Oh, yeah, I used to be such a Catholic.
You still believe in God?
Yeah, you guys believe in God. But I don't believe that God made man in his image. Because most of the shit that happens is because of men. Now, I think man was made in the devil's image, and women were created out of God. Because after all, women can have babies, which is kind of like creating. And which also counts for the fact that women are so attracted to men. Because let's face it, the devil is a hell of a lot more interesting. I slept with some saints in my day, and believe me, I know what I'm talking about. Poor
enough. So, the whole point of life, I think, is for men and women to get married so that God and the devil can get together and work it out.
No, we have to get married or anything.
Okay, so there she is. She's fantastic. I love her so, so very much. Okay, we're going to unplug this again, and I'm going to talk about Totoro. Totoro is my G-rated movie. This is a very slow, quiet film by Hayao Miyazaki. Who knows these movies? okay, many of you, that respects both the attention span of children and the attention to detail that children will give to something. It celebrates discovery and wonder and reverence. This is a movie that is about relationships and reconciliation, not a quest for redemption. It centers on the relationship between two sisters, their loving but preoccupied scholarly father, and their absent mother. The desire to be reunited with this mother shapes the narrative of the film. So, Mormon-related themes. We have animism. While the Japanese animism does not map perfectly onto Mormonism, we believe that all things created were created spiritually before they are created physically, so they have a spiritual component. But we don't generally attribute a personality to trees and rocks and rivers, because a personality would imply preference and agency, and we have put those things in the category of things to be acted upon, not things to act. However, we do have a little bit of personality with Mother Earth, who weeps and groans under the iniquity of men, and who would rejoice in being renewed. So we have a little bit of gray area, and in that gray area, I feel I have the room to present Miyazaki's film and vision as the unadulterated truth to my children, and so I do. So this animism also has a strong sense of wonder with the natural world, shown through this film, The Gleaming Treasure of Acorns, that just sparkle and catch the girl's attention, a love of gardening, and seeking divine help after our own efforts have proved desperately insufficient. Now, the first to see one of these forest spirits, the Totoro, is the little 4-year-old girl, May. She quickly discovers, however, that such experiences may not be demanded. There are times when the forest spirits will reveal themselves and times when they don't, and it bears no relation to what the child wants or deserves. Through hope, patience, and generosity, Satsuki, her older sister, is able to see the spirits as well, and the rapport they establish allows her to seek the help of the Totoro when Mei is lost later in the film. And the relationships between characters in this movie are fantastic. Now, the father I mentioned is a scholar. He doesn't have the same access to the nature spirits as his daughters have, but he recognizes their encounters for what they are, and he teaches them proper respect for these spirits. And the film shows this great balance of knowledge through deliberate study and knowledge through innocent experience, and how those things have to balance together. The mother is hospitalized for some unnamed ailment. The older daughter writes to her letters that sound like prayers of love and longing. The younger daughter is lost in trying to reach the mother to try to help her heal and return to their family. I can't help but see parallels with so many of our Mormon sisters who are seeking to return to their heavenly mother, whose love of their good father does not diminish the need for their absent mother. Now, this is a movie that children find delightful, and we just showed it in our neighborhood last night, and there's a little girl watching it who'd never seen it before, and she was just like lit up and so, so happy. For adults, this movie is terrifying. When May is lost, how many of you have children? Okay, have you had that moment where you've lost your child? Where maybe it's just in the grocery store, or like they're actually gone and you're at the point of calling the police? That is in this movie. And the kids have no idea how terrifying that is. Children are not scared by this at all. And at one point, while the entire community is looking for this little tiny girl, they find a sandal in the water that they've been dredging. And I have a daughter who we pulled out of a pond, who was gray and unconscious. And so this movie is terrifying for me. And kids don't see that at all, because they still live in this Miyazaki world where there's danger, but the danger is not stronger than the wonder and the beauty. So this scene is a good 7-8 minutes long, where they're waiting at the bus stop to give their dad the umbrella. And you see the two girls together. This little one gets tired. The older one holds her on the back, sheltered from the rain. And they wait and wait. And eventually, as the little one falls asleep. Look at that. How cute is that? Mm-hmm. There's a frog. It's so slow. We don't make movies for kids now. We don't expect that they can sit through 5 minutes of rain. But they did this last night, and when the Totoro comes with his ridiculous little leaf for an umbrella, they were so happy. And so I love the gentleness and the slow pace and the wonder of this film.
May slipping. Hold it over your head, like this.
So, for Comic-Con that we're going to this fall, we're making a Totoro costume for my little 7-year-old. He's really, really excited. The other kids will be different Miyazaki characters. 1 minute? It's got 5 minutes in the scene!
If we just watch this movie, it'll be a good session.
So good. Well, so these extra drops have fallen on him. So I like, too, that these spirits are discovering the world and enjoying it as well. But when Satsuki needs the help of the Totoro, she's able to get it. And that's a very Mormon thing, that when you need help, you can seek it. And even though you can't demand that God comes to see you or gives you the answer or tells you that the Book of Mormon's true right when you ask it, in these desperate times that we're there. Lots of inarticulate roaring of just joy. Yes.
Here comes the bus.
You can tell me when to stop it, Stephen, and I'll stop. This is the bus for the Totoro. It moves like the wind through the forest.
And
he gives them their gift. This gift is a little packet of acorns wrapped in a bamboo leaf. And so the girls plant this as a garden, and later the Totoro comes and is doing a dance around it, and they go out and dance with him. And they have this vision of it growing into a huge tree, and the next morning their little seeds have sprouted, and it's just wonderful. Okay, that's all my time.
You up next, John?
I'm up next.
Cables.
You know what? I'm not going to worry about it. I only have the two pictures, and I'll just speak.
Well, okay.
So I can fight with it and just describe.
You saw my losing battle there, didn't you?
All right. When Stephen first asked me to be part of the panel, I jumped at the chance. You know, Mormonism in movies. What I really love about this is it's Mormonism in mainstream movies. You know, whenever we talk about Mormonism in movies, it's usually Mormon movies. And I think that's great. And if you haven't read Randy's excellent article in BYU Studies from about 2007, I think.
So summer issue 2007.
On Mormon cinema.
Doubled in like next year when the book comes out.
Yeah. So. It's read it. It's great. But the reality is when we focus on like these Mormon movies, you know, and you know, this kind of writing, it distorts it a bit, because really the way Mormons engage movies is as patrons at the cinema watching these mainstream movies. Mormons don't go to a lot of Mormon movies, actually. That's why we don't have that many of them, even though there have been these different iterations to try and do it. So I thought, this is great. You know, I'm going to be able to talk about movies and Mormonism, and then I drew a big fat blank, because I thought, what are my favorite movies and what are the kind of things? And I had the same dilemma, like, should I twist this pretzel into, well, maybe there's Mormonism in, you know, this, in Goodfellas, I don't know, it's got to be there somehow. And so I love this because it forced me to think, you know, what, you know, which is always a dangerous proposition, But I thought, you know, what are the movies I love? And the reality is the movies I love are detective movies and gritty crime dramas. When I was 15, I, you know, despite my mom's vehement prohibition, I made it down to Blockbuster Video. Remember Blockbuster? You know, you go in and, you know, and I got Silence of the Lambs because I was dying to see this. It had come out and, you know, it had been nominated for all these Oscars, and snuck it into the house and watched Silence of the Lambs. Again, I'm sure much to my mom's horror if she had discovered me. And so with that in mind, thinking about, you know, what is it about me that loves these, you know, very, you know, ostensibly not Mormon movies, you know, these violent, gritty movies, but also has this fascination with Mormonism. So I'm going to talk through that. I don't know if the movies I'm going to be talking about have a lot to do with Mormonism, but they have a lot to do with me and what I find fascinating about Mormonism and these movies. First movie I'm going to talk about is The Big Sleep, 1946, Howard Hawks. Raise your hand if you've either seen or read the book. Okay, good. You got to do both. You're going to find out why shortly. One of the, you know, very quickly, the plot of The Big Sleep is Philip Marlowe. This is Raymond Chandler's first Philip Marlowe novel. He shows up at the big Sternwood mansion in Los Angeles because General Sternwood is hiring him because his daughter, Carmen, who is wild, as Marlowe finds out at the very beginning of the film when she throws herself at him, is being blackmailed. And so Marlowe goes on this, what becomes, you know, this, you know, we now know is Chandler-esque, you know, adventure of intricate plots and, you know, characters coming in and out and not being able to keep things straight. Famously in this movie, if you're aware of this story, at one point Howard Hawks was not sure who had murdered a character. A character is murdered, and they wire Raymond Chandler and say, who murdered him? And Chandler wires back, hell if I know. He doesn't know who was killed here. And so Marlowe goes through this. He ends up at Arthur Gwynn Geiger's bookstore. Now, this is only hinted at in the movie. This is why you have to read the book if you've only seen the movie. But Geiger's rare bookstore is peddling high-class pornography. So people will walk into Geiger's bookstore. And this is, by the way, my G movie. This was made in 1946. So this is only hinted at in the book, or in the movie, and it's all very explicit in the book. And Marlowe discovers that they are dealing in this high-class pornography. You go in and you rent, basically, these rare books that have these photos in them. And then he trails Geiger to his house. I want to talk about this house for a second, because this house is something that's always struck me in this movie. First of all, now, you know, when it was made in 1946, this seemed normal then. But now I watch this movie in 2014, and everybody's wearing, you know, suits and ties, and men are wearing hats, and it's black and white, and it's just pristine and beautiful, and it's shot on, you know, celluloid and none of this digital nonsense. This is the snob part that Stephen was talking about. And it's just so beautiful. And Marlowe goes to Geiger's house, and it's this great house up Laurel Canyon Boulevard in Los Angeles, if you're familiar with that. And this is where a lot of, you know, Marlowe's clients end up. It's not where movie stars live. It's where bankers live. It's where, you know, it's a really nice post-war middle class place. And it's raining, of course. It's a film noir. And when Marlowe pulls up and he's sitting outside just this lovely house, and then a gunshot goes off and he races in the house. And while he's running in, a car speeds off out of the driveway. And he runs in and he finds Carmen Sternwood there. And in the movie, she is dressed in kind of like an Oriental outfit. In the book, she's stark naked. And a flashbulb goes off. A picture's been taken of her. And Arthur Gwynn Geiger is dead on the rug. And his blood is soaking into this nice Oriental rug. This is a recurring theme kind of in a lot of Chandler's books and in The Big Sleep. And in a lot of film noir, place. This idea of place is very important. It's very, you know, powerful in these movies, that the places these characters end up are very different on the inside than what they seem on the outside. And I really am drawn to that. There's a voyeuristic quality about this, that we pull up outside this nice American house, and what's really going on inside is terrible stuff. Even in the movie, it is clear that Carmen Sternwood is high as a kite. They can't even, you know, kind of hush that up in the movie. And she has been drugged and photographed against her will by Geiger, who is going to put her photo in these books. Another part of this in the book that's very clear in the book, only vaguely hinted at in the movie, is that Geiger is gay, and Geiger's partner later gets revenge on Geiger's murderer. We won't say who that is or anything, but this is a big part of that. And so all of the things swirling around inside this house are just remarkable. And some of them are really terrible, and then some of them are a little sad that this, you know, gay couple has to hide this very, you know, aggressively in 1946 America, that they can't talk about this, although Geiger, not exactly a nice person. It struck me that this parallels my interest in Mormonism. And not, you know, I want to be clear, I'm not trying to like poke Mormonism and be like it's this nice thing on the surface and inside it's this seedy, terrible, crime-ridden thing. It's more that what's presented is usually a lot less interesting to me than what's underneath the surface and what we really get at with things. And that's why I say there's a voyeuristic quality. We all present, you know, our nice manicured houses to the world with our fresh-cut grass and the nice flower beds. And we all, regardless of how benign we may think it is, inside those homes, we all have secrets. Even if it's just a fight with a spouse that we just prefer people maybe not know about. But that is what makes people human and interesting to me. And that is very much the way I have interacted the last decade with Mormonism. That it is this nuclear religion that, you know, everybody wants to, you know, or that it wants to present itself as one thing. And I frankly kind of find that one thing kind of bland. What I find so interesting is what's going on inside and underneath the surface, and particularly with the history. You know, I'm a historian and focus more on that. And I think that makes Mormonism so much more vibrant and so much more interesting, and it's what gives it this really its power, very much like in The Big Sleep. This story is propelled forward by what's going on in these nice houses. In Chandler's second novel, Farewell, My Lovely, that was made into a movie as well with Dick Powell. It was called Murder, My Sweet. And at one point, Marlowe is kidnapped, and he's knocked unconscious, and he's taken to... he wakes up chained to a bed, and he is drugged, and he's there for like 3 days, and he finally, you know, through a bunch of stuff, he escapes, and he stumbles out onto like Main Street USA, you know, like with these houses that are just lovely. And so here's another sense of this this going on, that you know, Marlowe is stuck in these things, and this could be your next door neighbor's house, and think about the crazy stuff that's going on inside of it. Another theme of this is rebellion. You know, Marlowe very much goes through life, you know, needling just about everybody he comes across. And this is a big thing in these movies, that, you know, people don't like the way he behaves towards them. And at the beginning of the movie, Evelyn Rutledge, you know, the other Sternwood daughter, yells at him and says, "People don't talk to me that way." And, you know, he you know, mocks her for this and talks about how bad his manners are and that he grieves over them long evenings. And I really relate again to this sort of, not necessarily rebellion, but this sense of not feeling necessarily a part of things. And that's how I've gone through, you know, Mormonism is why I come to Sunstone, right? You know, you don't necessarily feel a part of things. And I think these detectives go through the world feeling that way. How am I on to 5 minutes? All right. Next movie is another detective movie, a little bit different, much more straightforward, and that's Blade Runner. I don't know if you have seen Blade Runner or not. If you haven't, you have to go see Blade Runner. It's just the best. This movie has Harrison Ford. It's directed by Ridley Scott. And again, like I say, it's much more, it's ostensibly much more straightforward. We have replicants, skin jobs. They are this takes place, and funny enough, this takes place in 2019. So in 2016, we're going to have robots that look exactly like humans. We've got that to look forward to, according to Blade Runner. These replicants escape off-world and come to Earth, and they are very dangerous. They're led by Rutger Hauer, and there's a few other, there are three others, and Harrison Ford, the Blade Runner, has to track them down. They have a four-year lifespan built. This would be what Hitchcock calls the MacGuffin, because they have a four-year lifespan built into them, so they're going to die soon. But for whatever reason, Harrison Ford has to track them down before it's too late. The film opens with Leon being interviewed. Leon's one of these replicants that has to be caught. And another Blade Runner is interviewing him, and he's asking him questions, and Leon is getting really, really agitated. And the questioner says, it's a test designed to provoke an emotional response. And as you go through Blade Runner, you realize that the replicants, the robots, are much more human than the humans in this movie. And they are fighting so hard and so desperately to stay alive. And it becomes really a story about identity. And what is your identity? And the fact that something that seems really simple, these simple questions that a Blade Runner will sit down and ask people to find out if they're a replicant or not, are very upsetting and cause this kind of emotional turmoil. And in people that are not really supposed to have emotions, although they grow their own emotions. And that, again, really resonates with me within my own experience in Mormonism, is trying to find that identity. You think it's one thing. These newer replicants believe that they're human, and then they find out that they're not. And it really traumatizes them, understandably. Their memories are fake. They're lied. They're really 3 or 4 years old, and their lives are not what they thought they were. And I see that very much, again, paralleling my experience in Mormonism, believing that you are on a path, and life just does not work out that way at all, ever. And you have this real sense of identity where you're going through and trying to understand who you are. And ultimately, at the end, if you're Harrison Ford, who may or may not actually be, shock, a replicant, the Blade Runner trying to hunt them down, you know, there's, Harrison Ford says he was not a replicant. Ridley Scott says he definitely was. And so even among the filmmakers, there's dispute over this. The last thing that I'll mention about Blade Runner, since I'm going on a little too long, is there's a lot, if you've watched this movie and really paid attention, there's a tremendous amount of eye symbolism in it. The movie opens and there's a quick shot, almost as if it's, you know, some sort of, you know, German postmodern film. There's a shot of an eyeball close up for just a second that reflects the landscape of this future dystopian Los Angeles. And then throughout, eyes repeat over and over. The replicants find out where Tyrell is, you know, the man who made them, from the person who makes eyes. And they, when a Blade Runner sits down and interviews people, he puts a machine up and it zooms in on their eyes so that he can watch what their eyes are doing. And we have to have some part of the rated R part of this. When Rutger Hauer finally discovers Tyrell, the man who made them, and he's trying to get him, he kills him by taking his thumbs and just shoving them into his eyes and digging them all the way back into his skull. It's really graphic. And we have the eyes that are the window to the soul, right? The eyes are how we see who someone is, and that is repeated throughout this film. That this is how we're going to discover who you are, is through your eyes. And Mormonism has that as well, right? That we have the, you know, but for me, this was something growing up, sort of like Stephen, very much like Stephen, actually, where God was not my friend who was watching out for me. God was watching for me to screw up so he could punish me. This is what the all-seeing eye was to me. And so it resonates with me, you know, again, maybe a little aggressively when he just digs that, you know, thumb in there. And, takes care of that, because that sense of the window to the soul and seeing who someone is through that has a very different meaning for me growing up. You know, for you know, as much as I am very fond of Mormonism today, as a child, it was borderline traumatic, the amount of shame and guilt I felt for, you know, and I was a good kid, by the way. I didn't do anything, you know, but feeling that. And so that went through. I'm going to read it's just short, Roy Batty's final speech, which has become iconic in, you know, science fiction and in film and cinema because it's so good, this is the main, you know, replicant, and he's just devastated Harrison Ford, and he could have killed him, and he chooses not to, and he sits there right before he's going to die, and he says, "I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time like tears in rain. Time to die." Thanks.
Is it my turn? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want me to hook you up?
Nope. I don't have any clips.
Oh, okay. Maybe I should turn on the lights and stuff.
I wish I would have gotten some clips, but that would have involved a level of skill that I didn't think I had. So. I thought about clips. That counts, right?
Just like thinking about sin leads you to sin.
Yes. Yes. I'll think about the clips and it'll work. It'll be just like that. Okay, so the two movies I picked, I feel like one of the things is not quite the other in this panel, because I'm not like one of the movie buffs. I like movies, but what I really like are stories. And I don't really care if it's a movie or a folktale or a myth or, you know, a novel. I just love stories, I think, or the Bible. I just think they're really important. That stories are things that transform us, and so I made lists and lists of movies, and then tried to decide which ones appealed to me. And there was something I decided on: the Muppet movie and Pan's Labyrinth. Who's seen the Muppet movie? Who's seen Pan's Labyrinth? Okay. Because I'm not sure how much I'm going to have to explain. So even if you haven't seen the Muppet movie, you know who the Muppets are. And it was actually one of the first movies that came to mind when I was thinking about movies that might be kind of Mormon. And here's why. So here you have this group of folk, they're just a little bit different from everybody else. We don't really discuss that they're a little bit different from everyone else. But they just don't quite fit in with everyone. This group of people, they have this sort of wide-eyed, joyful innocence about them. They're just a little bit nicer than everyone else. They don't swear. They don't seem to ever drink. They don't seem to have many vices. And they break out singing and dancing quite often, more than most folks, right? Their jokes are sometimes very mildly ribald. Appropriate for children, but with a wink for adults, you know? And whenever they get together, whenever they're traveling along or doing their thing, they seem to travel in packs. They seem to band together. Wherever they wander on their journey, they work as a team. They have things in common that they just sort of sense, this difference that they have from everybody else around them, this wide-eyed optimism, and this desire to make people happy and themselves happy. Like, that's kind of the point of Muppets, is to make people happy. I also, as I was thinking about Mormon themes in the Muppets, I was thinking about Gonzo and his beautiful chicken wife, Camilla. And I was thinking about how there's always this vague cadre of chickens traveling with them. Like, this big band of chicken sister chickens?
And I, you know, like, nobody ever talks about that, because Camille is clearly the first wife, or the first chicken. But, yeah. But it makes you wonder, what's going on there? But as we follow the Muppets on their epic journey, and it's led by a man. He's green. He's a frog, actually, not a man, but he is male. And you might also note that almost all of the striving actors in Muppets, well, all of the striving actors in Muppets are male. And there's a couple of ladies, but they play support roles. They really, really love the men, and they're kind of backup singers. And, yeah, so that also remains consistent. But as we follow them on their journey, they turn out to be, you know, pretty moral. They don't take their choices lightly, but they also are a little bit vain sometimes. Sometimes they're a little selfish. They're complicated. But they're also really good people. They're just really good people. You just like them. So they mirror us. They're a lot like us, only a little nicer. And you put all of this, I don't know, like, there's something just really kind of magical and otherworldly about them. And I think that is often how Mormons are viewed. You know, like, they're just not quite like the rest of us. And there's something about all of this, there's something about the Muppets that seems a little bit like naive or simplistic or something that the hipster, cynical, you know, worldly us looks at and thinks, oh, that's just for kids, or oh, that's a little too naive, or that's a little too... But the pitfalls of this, instead of trying to avoid them, we just dive right into this innocence and revel in it. And there's something about that, this joyful, like, we're going to break out in song and dance, that turns this fault of being naive into a virtue. Anyway, so... that's my really deep thoughts about the Muppets.
You didn't sing. What's wrong?
What's that?
You didn't sing.
Oh, I didn't sing? Well, I don't have really the voice of a singer, but I can do moving right along. But loose and fancy free. Getting there is half the fun. Come get there with me. So as far as Pan's Labyrinth, I really wanted to do this movie because I'll explain it a little more, because it's not as universally known. I think maybe only film geeks have watched it, so there should be some of those in here. But it's a really dark movie. It's beautifully dark in the way that, like, Tim Burton movies are beautifully dark. It's kind of a magical realism where you have a fantasy world right alongside a human world, and they're both really dark worlds. And the protagonist is a little girl. She's about 11, 12, 13. She's sort of prepubescent. And one of the themes that runs throughout the movie that is very Mormon, and in fact sort of the whole point of the movie, is she is actually the daughter of a king. And so she has a divine nature, and she's trying to return to her heavenly parents. She's trying to return to find her divine self and discover her father, who is actually a great king in her fantasy world. In the real world, her father is dead, and her mother is married to a very obedient
man who is a general, and he sees her mother, who is pregnant with his child, as, and he says flat out at some point, she's just a means to make babies. I don't love her. She's just a baby-making machine. So, you know, there's some Mormonism in there. But the little girl is, one of the themes that goes throughout this is she's trying to find this path back to her father. She is being pulled back and forth between her agency to make choices and this sense of obedience. She's being told what to do from lots of different forces. Both the fantastical forces and the earthly forces are telling her what to do. They're telling her to be obedient. And as she is interacting, she's having to make choices. She's having to decide, do I trust this? Am I going to be obedient? Or am I going to choose agency? And in fact, one of those points, one of the points at which she does that, she has to decide, is she going to eat the forbidden fruit? And this is the moment that most people who have seen this movie, like, they throw up their hands and go like, ah! Because it is the most frightening, terrifying point of this movie. So she is on a quest. She has found the magic, and they all are all in threes, which is another, you know, like mystical. It's a fairy tale convention. It's also a biblical convention to have things in threes. So she has to go on three quests, and she has to find three items in order to. And so one of the quests is to take this key that she found in the first quest and find these three doors and figure out which one is the appropriate door and open it up in order to find this dagger that she needs. And sitting in front of these doors is a sleeping monster who has, and he's super creepy. He's the creepiest thing ever. And it's very scary. And she has three fairies leading her in. And the fairies and the faun that gave her the instructions all tell her, whatever you do, don't eat the fruit. Don't eat anything. Don't eat it. But she didn't get dinner the night before. And the fairies kind of mislead her because the fairies are telling her, use your key on this door, this door, this door. They're pointing at it, but there's something about her that knows it's not the right door. And so for whatever reason, and you as the audience are sitting here saying, follow the fairies, do what they say, open the door that they're pointing at. You know, you're like, no, don't be disobedient. But she opens the wrong door and it turns out to be the right door. And so a few moments later, she's walking by the table and here's the sleeping, you know, scary monster. And he's pale. They call him the pale man. He's pale and his skin is sagging. He's disgusting. And here's this giant feast, you know. And she decides, and the fairies are rushing around her. No, don't eat it, don't eat it, don't eat it. But they had just misled her, you know. So she's got this choice between obedience and so she eats the fruit, and it turns out really badly. The pale man wakes up and bites the heads off two of her fairy friends, and it's all very tragic. And when she gets back, the pan is mad at her and makes her swear that she'll be obedient. Look at what happens when you're not obedient. And yet it's so much more ambiguous than that, because the obedience worked for her one time, or didn't work. The disobedience worked for her the first time and then didn't work for her the second time. And so then, you know, the final one is also a very religious tale, in that she is asked to either sacrifice her baby brother. And you know, where have we heard tales like that? You know, they're in, you know, Abraham sacrifice, and she has to make a choice. Am I going to be obedient? Am I going to use this dagger that I was, you know, like, or am I going to follow sort of my own choice? And do I give spoilers, or should I just leave it up in the air? You don't give. I'm not going to tell you. All right. Really? Okay. So you know, like, she has this Abrahamic choice to make. Am I going to be obedient, or am I going to use my agency to make what feels more to me the moral choice? And I just don't, I don't know. I don't know if I feel good about giving that away. No, I'm not going to do it. You're going to have to go watch it. You're going to have to go watch it. And then you'll find out, too, whether it worked out for her or not. And it might be ambiguous. So
I think that for me, the struggle between agency and obedience is like one of the biggest tensions in Mormonism. And to me, I feel like that tension is actually the point. Like when we go to church, we will hear obedience, 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 obedience. And we, the quirky Mormons, I assume that we're all the quirky Mormons in here. We tend to emphasize like personal revelation. But I feel like that the answer is somewhere in the middle of those two extremes. Like that there's the ambiguity is there for a reason, and the tension between those two things are actually the point. And struggling between trying to figure out like when is obedience going to be the thing that serves me, and when is it that I have to break away and make a choice because I know something that they don't know.
I wrote mine out, so I apologize for that. But my wife said if I didn't, that I would talk for 35 minutes. So, if you'll bear with me. And before I talk about my movies, I'm grateful to go last because I wanted to say something about this session in general and why I think it's an important session. Because when you look at it, there are a lot of other sessions going on here today that seem, and yesterday and the day before that, seem a lot more important, and issues that are really pertinent and pressing on Mormonism right now about gender issues and feminism and mental health and doctrine and theology. And we're here talking about movies, and I have actually one of the biggest crowds I've seen, which is great. But there's a reason why I think that we're here and why I think movies are important. And, you know, maybe eternally, in the great scheme of things, they're not entirely the most important thing. But in recent years, I've come to subscribe more to the view taken from Doctrine and Covenants 68:4 that any human statement or expression, quote, when moved upon by the Holy Ghost, shall be Scripture, shall be the will of the Lord, shall be the mind of the Lord, shall be the voice of the Lord, and the power of God unto salvation. Not all potentially scriptural statements are created equal. They don't all live up to the same standard. But any sincere statement of belief, has that quality to it, a scriptural quality. And that could come from nature, art, literature, science. And when we look at these things, we can expand our canon and our theology and find spiritual sustenance in unexpected places. C.S. Lewis was primarily a historian and a critic. We think of him for his apologetics and for Narnia. But my favorite book of his is An Experiment in Criticism, where he's talking about criticism. And he says that there are no good or bad texts. There are just generous or selfish readers. And if we work to have eyes to see, we can see. And so when we're generous and we're open, we can discern the divine in cinematic works by Carl Dreyer or Robert Bresson or Ingmar Bergman or Miyazaki or Jim Henson or whoever it is. I've had powerful experiences watching everything from Blue Valentine to Teletubbies. And if you can feel the spirit while you're watching Teletubbies, then that is, and I love Teletubbies, by the way, but it's not normally a spiritual experience. There's this one time that it was for me, and then when I see that episode again, it won't be, because it's different every time. But the spirit can speak to you if you're in a prison in Liberty, Missouri, or if you're watching a film in someone's living room or here at Sunstone. So, with that said, I didn't have much trouble picking my films. It took me about 30 seconds to say, oh yeah, I want to talk about Babe, Pig in the City, which was George Miller's 1998 sequel to Babe from 1995, and a Spike Lee film, 25th Hour, which he released in 2002. So I'll talk about them each in turn, but as I was thinking about them together for the first time, I realized that they're both representations, like Pan's Labyrinth, of an archetype of the plan of salvation, a very particular one at that. Both films depict a character passing through a hellish world in a search for personal and even communal redemption for their friends. The protagonists are each situated as leaders of a small group of friends, isolated in a big city, perhaps something like John Bunyan's Vanity Fair.
And through their faith and their fortitude, they guide their friends through this purgatory, a kind of symbolic river Styx, to a healthier and even heavenly place on the other side. Their friends are key to their journey as well, but ultimately, the two protagonists, Babe and Monty, from each of the films, must pass through this purgatory alone, seeking for and eventually embodying the grace of God. Because of the ratings and because of the subject matter, and the films depict this in very different ways, obviously. So I'll begin with Babe. Sequels are always hard to pull off, and Babe in particular seemed a tough act to follow because despite being labeled a children's film, the original film was nominated for Best Picture Oscar in 1995, and it taught an important lesson about racism, about humility, and about looking at someone's heart rather than at their appearance. Babe triumphs as a sheep herder, and he coheres the farm into a utopian family. So where can you go from there? Well, wisely, Babe Pig in the City begins by knocking him off his pedestal. Babe causes a mishap for the farmer as he repairs his well. In a sequence, which was I first heard as a joke told by President Hinckley in General Conference, where the farmer falls down the well, and then the thing hits him on the way down, and then he lets go of it, and it falls down on him again, and he gets completely incapacitated. This is Babe's fault, because he trips the farmer up. And so what happens is that this pushes the farm to the brink of foreclosure, and in 10 swift minutes, Babe is transformed from the farm's savior to its destroyer. The second thing you do is you take him away from the farm entirely. The farmer's wife, Esma Hoggett, moves from a supporting role in the first film to the human lead in the second film, and a beautiful performance, when she takes Babe to a sheep herding show far away. But thanks to another mistake of Babe's in the airport, they get stranded in the big city. They miss the show. And they're stuck in a place as foreign to the pastoral landscapes of the farm as possible. It's hostile to animals. It's the only place that they can find refuge is a hotel that takes them in through the back door because there are laws prohibiting animals inside buildings. The city is busy, it's unkind, and it's frightening, especially once Mrs. Hoggett is arrested for assaulting an officer when she was just bumbling along in her usual farmly way. So Babe's all by himself, and then the third thing that happens is they take away Babe's gifts. There are no sheep here, as the other animals remind him. There are no sheep dogs, there are no horses. And in the one scene when he attempts to use his secret incantation that proved his salvation in Babe, I can't say it, it's the Ba-Mu-Re, that's how he wins in Babe, but he tries that in Babe Pig in the City, and he's attacked by a Doberman and by a Bull Terrier. It doesn't work on dogs. But it's that scene, which is what we're going to find right now, after a harrowing chase through back alleys and dumps, that's also the turning point for him. He becomes a savior in a very new way, a literal sense, when one of the dogs who is trying to kill him, go for Babe Pig in the City, saving the dog.
Okay.
Thanks. So this, they call it a pit bull, but it's a bull terrier, and it's trying to kill him. It wants him dead. Its chain gets caught on a lawnmower, it trips off a bridge into a canal, and it's hanging there with its head in the water. So this animal that wants Babe to die, and will kill him if it gets a chance, is now going to die. And so Babe he has a choice to make. Click on saving the dog.
This one?
Yes.
All right.
Thanks.
I do have 7 minutes.
Okay.
Click. Come on. Sorry.
No, it's all right.
Like I say, this computer...
It's working better than mine.
No, it's not.
Do you guys want to know what happens to the dog?
It's so good. Let me try again later. But
you gotta install a new Flash player. It's beautifully scored and it's well acted by all the animals there. But no, really, it really is. The dog is going to die. Everyone turns away. That first chimpanzee who you saw says, "Come on, honey, let's go." And they've seen this before in the city. It's a doggy dog world. And that's it for that animal. And so everyone's leaving, and they hear a splash because Babe jumped in the water. And he pushes a boat over to the bull terrier and gets it underneath him and gets him up out of the water and saves his life. And he swims to shore, and everyone is staring at him flabbergasted. They don't know what to make of this because why would anyone do that? And then they all crowd around him and start saying, "My humans abandoned me. My humans threw me in a sack and threw me off a bridge. I've never had a human. And please help me. I'm hungry, sir." And so Babe has this new community around him, a new herd. But it's not sheep. It's It's dogs. It's cats. It's a goldfish whose bowl breaks. It's chimpanzees, and it's an orangutan who doesn't have a father. These are the outcasts of their society, the lame. Literally, as one dog uses a wheelchair, they're the prostitutes and the publicans and the murderers and the adulterers. And Babe accepts them all. He loves them all.
It's doing an advertisement, but it's
okay. We're past it now, so we're good. Thanks, though. Babe spent the film ostensibly looking for Mrs. Hoggett, who he's lost. But the lost sheep he's sent to find are everywhere, literally coming out of the woodwork. He finds himself the least of the city animals, and at first they esteem him not, and they see him as smitten and afflicted. The dogs call him a cat, the chimps call him a what's-it, and the orangutan reduces him to a walking slab of bacon. But he bears their griefs, he's bruised for their iniquities, and when he calls them, they hearken and are healed. And by diverting from what he thought was his quest to save the farm, Babe not only saves all of them, but he eventually saves the farm as well. In a way, he also saves the city, redeeming not just its animal inhabitants, but allowing us to see the beauty in its deformities. The grace of Mrs. Hoggett flying through a ballroom in an inflatable clown suit, which is a beautiful scene. The grandeur of the skyline, which is a conglomeration of urban landmarks from all around the world. And the dignity of a mute Mickey Rooney in one of his last roles in face paint as a clown, performing not a pastiche of his early films like Boys Town and the Let's Put on a Show musicals with Judy Garland, but an homage to them. A difference that turns on the fact that this mute, obese clown is performing for a group of children with cancer. They are the outcasts of the human society that are equivalent to the animals who surround Babe. Rooney's clown is ministering unto the least of these, and we see that both he and Babe are standing in for Christ, doing the best they can despite their own infirmities and their weaknesses. That's Babe. So in my 4 minutes, I'll do 25th Hour, which is a completely different film. Monty Brogan, the main character there, played by Edward Norton, he has plenty of weaknesses, and he hardly saves anybody. He's an Irish kid from Staten Island, and he's made his living and his whole life as an Upper East Side drug dealer, making a fortune, as one friend describes it, off the misery of other people. It was too good to last, and before the film begins, Monty has been picked up by the cops and sentenced to 7 years in Otisville Penitentiary. The film takes place in the 24 hours before he has to check into prison, hence the title, and there are a few scenes like his arrest that are shown in flashbacks. And he travels around the city in those 24 hours saying goodbye to the people and the places that he loves. The people are remarkably few. His only real friends are two kids from his childhood, Jacob and Francis, along with his father and his girlfriend, Natural. Although he suspects that she was the one who reported him to the cops because they knew exactly where he kept the drugs. Each character is filled with remorse over either their own actions or not intervening to stop Monty's actions. His father reveals great grief over his past alcoholism and how he emotionally abandoned Monty after his mother died. Jacob, a sexually repressed middle school teacher played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, brilliant performance, he's tormented over his attraction to one of his students. Francis, a hotshot Wall Street trader, covers his life's emptiness with a veneer of bravado and machismo, but he's entirely hollow inside. He has nothing. Natural knows that Monty blames her for his arrest, but she can't find the words to deny it or to comfort him. But Monty is the most guilt-ridden of all. In the film's most famous scene, which we won't show, he addresses himself in the restroom mirror of his father's bar in Staten Island, and he launches a tirade of F-words against every ethnic and religious group in the city. And I'll say the letter F. So he says, F the homosexual Chelsea boys, F the uptown brothers, F the black-hatted Hasidim, the Upper East Side wives, the cops, the Muslims, the Korean grocers, the Puerto Ricans and the Dominicans, the homeless, the Catholic Church and its pedophilic priests, and even Jesus Christ himself. 7 hours on the cross, a weekend in hell, and all the hallelujahs of the Legion Angels for eternity, he yells at him. Try 7 years in Otisville. He damns the entire city, praying that it burns to the ground and that the waters will rise to cover the whole rat-infested place. And then when his rage is spent, he looks at himself in the mirror, his own reflection again, and he says, no, F you, Montgomery Brogan. You had it all and you threw it away. and we can see his remorse just burning. He's taking it out on everybody and everything, but it's because of his own sins. And if this were all that were happening, 25th Hour would be an excellent addition to Spike Lee's body of work, but not a revelatory film. However, the entire city becomes the most powerful character in the film because real life intervened when the script was already greenlit and they were getting ready to go into production, and two planes crashed into the World Trade Center. And Spike Lee is one of New York City's most quintessential filmmakers, and I guess it was impossible for him to make a movie about somebody saying goodbye to New York without the film becoming an elegy and actually saying goodbye to a New York City that would never exist again. The same New York that existed before 2001 was gone. And so you see it in the background. While Monty is walking the streets, there are flowers tied to abandoned bicycles, and there are shrines to fallen firefighters. And there's one tremendously difficult scene to watch where there's a gaping pit in the ground with construction workers outside Francis's apartment window by Wall Street. There's no way to exist in New York City in 2002 without this ever-present feeling of loss, of remorse, and of solidarity. And that's the New York that Monty is leaving. I personally don't know anyone that was killed or even affected on September 11th directly. But this still admittedly makes the film very personal to me, and I'm enough of a phenomenologist to believe that it's those personal relationships to films which make them so moving to us. I moved to Manhattan on September 12, 2002, a year and a day later, just before the film was released, actually. And so the New York City that I knew was covered in signs of missing people and in those bouquets of wilting flowers and pictures of firefighters. My wife got a job next door to Ground Zero, so at a hotel, so I would walk past there frequently at night, past the guards with the Uzis. And that exact same scene that I saw reflected in the film later when I saw it. And even when I, for my own sins or for my own seeking a place of solace, wanted someplace to go, I wound up at Carl Schurz Park, which is on the East River on the Upper East Side, on the exact same bench where Spike Lee had Edward Norton sit to film his scenes when he's pondering his sins. So when I saw that in the film, it immediately brought all of that to me. And that's not something that can be replicated for other viewers, but nor does it have to be, because we can all have our own experience with it, and we can all, every time we see something, have a different experience with it. And we've all screwed up. We've all sinned, and we've all created our own purgatories. We've all suffered for our own mistakes, and we've all mourned with those who mourn and tried to comfort those who stand in need of comfort. And that's where 25th Hour becomes scriptural for me. It's the metaphor of the human condition. We're all effed up, as he says. We're all lost sheep. We all grope in the darkness for someone to save us, but as often as not, we find no one but each other. Other travelers groping in the dark and trying to make sense of the evil and darkness that sometimes surround us, like on that morning in 2001. We hurt each other, like Monty's friends deliberately hurt each other. We betray each other, like Monty's drug associate Kostya betrayed him to the police. And we abandon each other, like Monty begs Francis and Jacob not to do. He keeps saying, stick with me one more hour, you're good to go just a bit more, because he's deathly afraid of being on his own. Finally, he seeks blood atonement for his sins. He wants to pay a physical penance from his flesh. And so he asks, I got to give away some of the ending or else I can't really discuss this film. He asks Francis to beat him senseless and to disfigure his face before he's sent to prison because he's deathly afraid of going into prison as a pretty boy. A small little Irish kid, he thinks he'll get eaten alive in there. So that's his solution. And the altercation nearly kills Monty, but it saves Jacob and Francis. And it pushes Jacob into a sexual and emotional maturity, and it forces Francis to finally face his demons. It also allows Monty in the car ride to prison to see the Korean grocers, the African Americans, the Muslims, and all New York City, all of New Yorkers as his brothers and his sisters. He waves goodbye to their smiling faces, confident in a New York that will rise united from the ashes, which is symbolic as well as literal. And as they drive up the West Side Highway, Monty's father talks about the possibility of escape, of driving west across the George Washington Bridge as far as the road will take them. And this is the 25th hour of the title, and the possibility each of us has of remaking our own lives, of being born again as a new man or a new woman, of finding a Zion in the desert and finding God. Monty doesn't make it, not yet, at least. But like the great tragedies of the past, the film lays out that opportunity for us. If we seize it, we can make it to Babe's Farm. We can find the beauty in the fallen city, and we can live life the way it should be lived, as Monty's father says. We can live it with forgiveness for ourselves and love for everyone around us, no matter how they are. Like you were saying at the very beginning, to accept people and go with them on their journeys and not try to change them, but just to love and accept them. And if that's not the chief message of the scriptures, then I don't know what is. And that's all I have to say.
We'll end on that note. Thanks for geeking out with us. It was fun.
Thank you.